take a minute to check your social battery. How's it doing? It's easy to ignore our needs and spread ourselves too thin. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/popcastpod today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/popcastpod.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your love and hate, if you know, you know, of music, news, and criticism. I am your host, John Caramonica. Some of you are exulting right now, and probably some of y'all are cringing. I understand how this functions. That was In the Heights, the title track from In the Heights, the movie, which is the adaptation of the Tony-winning Broadway musical In the Heights, the product of Lin-Manuel Miranda, a later of Hamilton. In the Heights was just released. It's in theaters. It's on HBO Max, which is where I saw it. It is maybe the first kind of big, loud movie release of the post-pandemic era, of this scale at least. And it is causing quite a stir. Many, many people love it and are embracing it. There are also very intense conversations about representation, colorism, and more that have been brought up in the press and critical cycle following the release. Today on Popcast, we're going to have two segments. First, Isabella Herrera and Sandra Garcia are here, and we're going to talk about the movie, the premiere, and a lot of the critical conversation that's been going on around the film. Later, Lena Wilson is going to call in with the musical theater energy and talk about the differences between In the Heights, the stage play, and In the Heights, the film. But first, Isabella is here. Sandra's here. Hello. Welcome.
Hi.
By way of introduction, okay, so if you've been listening to podcasts for a while, you know Isabella. She's been here before. But we have some new news, which is Isabella is in week two. Is that correct? Week two?
Correct. Week two.
Week two of a year-long critical fellowship at the Times. She has an nytimes.com email address.
That's right. Clap for her. It's really happening, friends.
I want to say Isabella emailed me months ago. We were talking about it. She applied, made it happen. She's here. Immediately, I was like, hey, how wonderful that you're in the building now. It makes it that much easier for you to come and talk about Lin-Manuel Miranda. How about that?
I'm ready.
I know. I could tell from when we talked last week, I don't know if you were wearing long sleeves, but you were rolling something up. It was a sleeve or something. I could tell you're in deep preparation. So Isabella is here. Also, first time on podcast, Sandra Garcia is here. Sandra is a reporter in Style. Sandra is the homie. And for the purpose of this conversation, also crucially, Sandra went up to Washington Heights at the United Palace Theater and reported on premiere night for In the Heights. So maybe let's start there. Sandra, can you tell me a little bit about the neighborhood in the wake of In the Heights, the premiere? You were talking about how the plaza that's like on the right side of the box office of the theater, they sort of transformed it. Take us through what that corner was like and what Broadway was like on that night.
They had completely built a set on it. So that corner, Plaza de las Americas is called, or, you know, Plaza of the Americas. It was just a regular street years ago where people would sell, you know, lotion and fruit and shoes. And it was mainly Dominican vendors as far as I knew. And then the city turned it into a plaza. They kind of put concrete blocks down. And so now it feels more like a walkthrough, a walkway. And vendors still go there, but it's no longer a street. And that is the space that the production team, I want to say, or someone for In the Heights used to sort of set up a faux bodega. And right next door is the United Palace, which is like the most gorgeous place uptown.
Amazing theater. A tremendous place to see music. I've seen Ozuna there, Aventura. If you have not seen Aventura at the United Palace, you have missed out on something very special, I am sorry to say. Not that long ago, they started booking indie rock acts and things like that. I saw Bon Iver there. Tremendous place to see live music. And also Lin-Manuel, if I'm not mistaken, Lin-Manuel has a history with that theater. I think maybe he bought a sound system for it or helped was part of the restoration, something along those lines.
That's right. Before he had his success on Broadway, he fundraised to buy the theater a projector to make it a movie theater. And he also helped install it.
And Sandra, for part of that piece, you were interviewing people in the neighborhood. First of all, did they shut Broadway down or they did not shut Broadway down?
They did not shut Broadway. It's hard to shut Broadway down.
I understand, but you know, I mean, look, they've certainly shut big streets down for lesser reasons.
You're right.
I thought maybe they did the honor. But anyway, you were obviously interviewing the folks in the film, but also you were interviewing people in the neighborhood about the movie, about Lin-Manuel. What was the tenor of those conversations? How were people receiving the kind of spectacle of In the Heights, big picture?
Everyone was really excited. It's not very often that you have a movie opening at the United Palace Theater in the Heights. And especially after a pandemic when people were not expecting a crowd of any sort or any celebrity to come up there. But yeah, they were really excited. A lot of people I spoke to were very happy to see The Heights in any Hollywood movie or production. But most people wanted to sort of find out what was going on. And once they did, they were just like, oh, I know Lin. I know that guy.
Like on a personal level, like actually no, like not like heard of no, like actually yeah. No, like no, for real.
Yeah, like I see him, like I've seen him. These are, you know, he's a good guy, like mostly everyone had a positive opinion about him.
First of all, did either of you guys see the stage play in the Heights?
Many times. You did? Yes.
I did not see it, actually.
And I'm in between y'all, which is I saw it only at the Lincoln Center Performing Arts Library, where you can like rent a VHS tape or DVD or something that has a solitary recording of In the Heights. That's like just there, you know, if you have a library card, you could take it out. Because before Hamilton came out, I was like, I should probably see In the Heights because I don't really see musical theater like that. Sandra, what was your young Sandra take on In the Heights back then?
I first saw In the Heights in 2012, which was still late in the game for the play. And I just could not believe, honestly, you know, honest to God, could not believe that there were people in a theater having conversations that I was so aware of, you know, like needing someone to co-sign for your apartment or having to move your salon out of the Heights. I just felt like, how do these people on Broadway know what's happening in my hood? And that grabbed me. It was really impressive.
Isabella, you come to the film cold then, not having seen it on stage. What was your Lin-Manuel vibe? What was your Hamilton vibe? How did you arrive to day one of watching In the Heights?
So I grew up in Chicago, and I knew about In the Heights in high school, like when it came out, it was, I think, 2008, 2009. It always kind of held, just like Washington Heights itself, kind of held this like mythical place in my head, like the symbolic place of like Dominicanness in the U.S., something that I wasn't experiencing because I was in Chicago, right? And Chicago is like a very Mexican Puerto Rican city. So that was a different experience, but it kind of like was the symbolism of like, wow, this is a Dominican neighborhood. And coming to the film, it was not quite the representation of a Dominican neighborhood that I thought it was going to be. I think that's kind of like baked into what the film is trying to do, which is like present the neighborhood as this like Latino melting pot, which we can discuss. It was kind of coming to it as like, okay, I know Hamilton. I know, you know, In the Heights is this like, wow, Dominicans on Broadway sort of thing. But I hadn't like really dived into it.
And so when you did see it, was there anything outside of the representational issues, which we'll get into in a minute? Is it impressive to you as musical theater, as writing? Is it unimpressive to you, you know, as dance, as any of these other kind of discrete parts of a big production like this? Were there any things that jumped out at you aesthetically that you said, ah, this really is impressive or, I don't know, this kind of like doesn't do the work for me.
There were definitely some moments of the songs that I thought were impressive, like reinventions of like reggaeton or merengue in some of the songs that they like kind of used a show tune format, which I never would have thought was possible. One thing that I did like is sort of like the way the physicality or like the materiality of the neighborhood comes in. Like I remember specifically at like in the opening number, the water hose sort of goes into the song. And then, you know, he uses like the sewer as kind of like a record scratch.
Where the street kind of becomes the music in essence.
Yeah.
Like suggesting the inseparability of a neighborhood's physicality and musical / creative identity.
That's what Washington Heights is like. Like music is everywhere. Like music is on every corner and sound is on every corner. So it was like, okay, I see that, you know.
Sandra, what about yourself? Watching the film, what are some things that jumped out at you that spoke loudly to you in any direction?
It was nice to see a neighborhood that I had spent so much time in during my formative years growing up in such a big production. Like Highbridge Pool, you know how many afternoons I spent in that pool, and just to see it sort of become the set for such a big musical number was just like, wow.
I'm glad you mentioned the pool, because the song that's being performed in that pool sequence is 96,000. It's about the winning lottery ticket. Let's listen to a bit of 96,000. In the sort of post-game dissection of In the Heights, there's been a lot of talk about John Chu, who is the director, who directed, I don't know if it's several of the Step Up movies, but certainly in that franchise. And a lot of people were very impressed with the dance numbers and how they were represented on screen. And I was actually kind of bummed I didn't see it in a theater, because I feel like they would have been even more effective. But to me, the most effective of the dance numbers was the pool number, was 96,000. Some of the other ones on my maybe perhaps too small TV, which I should probably rectify, didn't quite hit. Exactly. It was like, I often think I need a bigger television, but certainly when I was watching this, I was like, yeah, I need about like 30 more inches on this television to really get it right. What did y'all make of the dancing? And there was also a great, I believe was an interview with the choreographers on Jezebel that I was really into. Really, really sharp piece.
I personally thought the choreography was like really well done. Really, really well done. That, and also the Paciencia y Fe number was really well done. I read that they rented out old MTA subway cars in order to do it. And that I thought was like really, really beautiful. And I also wish that I had a larger screen to watch, because I just watched it like projected on my wall, and like probably the colors were off and stuff. So
one of the things in a musical of this nature is a lot of the cultural specificity is going to come through, not just in the music, but in the dance. And in a lot of ways, the dance felt maybe a little more current than the music. The music feels very, you know, Lin-Manuel is a musical theater guy. You know, he's raised on the stuff from the 60s and the 70s, like things that, you know, I certainly wasn't raised on. And his kind of gambit, as you described it before, Isabella, is finding points of intersection between more modern music and those older forms and those older, almost like ideologies of musical theater. If anything, the dancing felt a little more contemporary than the songs.
I think especially with like some of like the hip hop numbers, it felt like, you know, and I know that's Lin-Manuel's thing. You know, it felt like a, like there's like a drum break in 96,000 that sounds like New York City of Mine. Like it sounds like a Nas song, you know. I don't know. I do think on the music note, one thing that was striking to me is how little actual Dominican music is in the soundtrack. There's a lot of like salsa, there's a lot of son cubano, there's a lot of hip hop, but I would say like maybe just Vanessa's song, which I believe is It Won't Be Long Now, is like the only one that is like identifiably like merengue and has like a small bachata interlude.
Yeah.
that really stood out to me as a music person, to be like, this is a story about In the Heights, but there's just sort of like ambition to have this broader like Latin music category. And that felt a little strange, I have to say.
If you're a keen-eared listener, you know that the intro at the beginning of the show is an Aventura album title, but there's none of that really, or hardly any of that in this rendition of Washington Heights. And, you know, these musical theater is fantasy, right? There's the scene late in the film where Benny and Nina are dancing on the side of the building. Some of it is meant to be non-literal. But I think what we're circling around, and now I think we should probably land at, are these broader issues about who is in this film, what story it tells, and who was chosen to tell it. So it is Tuesday, the 15th now. Yesterday, Lin-Manuel put out a public apology on Twitter about the lack of dark-skinned actors and actresses in this film, and not adequately representing the full mosaic of who lives in Washington Heights. Isabella, can you talk about a little bit of what led up to that? Because that didn't come just totally out of nowhere.
I feel like this conversation actually started when the trailer for the movie came out. I remember last year, there were sort of like a lot of conversations online because the trailer depicted like white and light-skinned Latinos primarily. And I saw some discussion about it online, but it wasn't really until I would say on Friday when Felice Leon from The Root, she published an interview with some of the cast members and
the director,
John Chu. John Chu, the director, and pretty much like openly asked, like, you know, it's pretty, you know, a stark erasure of like dark skinned Afro Latinos. What's going on here? And then I sort of saw like online that the conversation pick up about like colorism and what it means to the fact that there were like very few Black Dominicans or Black Latinos included in this film, which is supposed to be about Washington Heights, a Dominican community.
Isabella, to that point, you had earlier pointed me to a thread from Carmen Phillips, who is the editor of Autostraddle, who talked about the colorism and also In the Heights' relationship to queerness. And so I want to read just a couple of these tweets. It's a really good thread. I loved In the Heights with my entire soul. Lots of people have talked about it as a Latinx project, but it also matters that it's about Caribbean Latinxes. We're marginalized in representation, even within the larger group. In the Heights has Tim's on Concrete and little girls getting their thick curls combed into ponytails in kitchens so narrow, they might as well be hallways. Three kids to one bed, sweat, salchicha con huevos, all of it.
My mother. Salchichon! I'm sorry.
Can we please start with Sandra screaming salchichon? So oh my God.
That's so good.
Peter, dude. You can pull that and make that the funk flex bomb at the beginning of the episode. It's totally fine.
Yo, I'm so sorry, Pedro. I'm just going to be quiet.
Please don't. I've seen some Afro-Latinxes say that In the Heights was the largest amount of Afro-Latinxes they'd seen on screen at one time. And I've seen other Afro-Latinxes note the lack of dark-skinned Afro-Latinxes present for a film about Washington Heights. I personally think both are true. And then there's several more tweets. And this kind of gets at the struggle and the tug of war that this film is trying to pull off. And I think that's kind of where the Lin-Manuel apology comes in. Where him saying, I'm trying to hold space to feel good about what we did, but also at the same time, accept that maybe there are shortcomings here. Isabella, when you saw how quickly he kind of jumped in to apologize, put out the fire, however you want to think about it, how did that strike you? Did it strike you as inevitably he was going to do this? Did it strike you as a genuine acknowledgement of a potentially larger or structural problem in the film and also in Hollywood broadly construed?
I don't really know whether it's my place to accept or reject his apology. I'm a white Dominican girl, but it does to me seem like it's part of this like larger ecosystem of like apologies from celebrities that has become like so commonplace online.
Seriously.
The like iPhone Notes app apology that people put up when they, you know, make a mistake. It's really hard not to read it with like a cynical eye of like, you're trying to save face after the wrongdoing instead of like listening to these conversations or having been listening to these conversations for a long time.
Sandra, in watching the film and then in seeing how it's been received, how did this sort of path to a Lin-Manuel apology, how did that strike you?
I mean, I expected it because like Isabella said earlier, he got a lot of flack for the trailer and unfortunately, the people are right. There isn't proper representation of Black Latinos in the movie. And it's hard to deny, to the point where I expected him to just come out and say, hey, I'm sorry about this, but we tried, you know, which he did.
If it wasn't Washington Heights specifically, which is a neighborhood like we all know and, you know, have been to, if it's not Washington Heights, if it's, I don't know, Tissue Box Heights or something, you know, a non-actual neighborhood. Sorry, it's the first thing I saw. It's the first thing I saw. It's the first thing I saw on my desk.
Hey, John.
Yeah.
John.
Yes.
How are the rents in Tissue Box Heights?
Well, they're going up.
John.
I'm so sorry. It's literally the first thing I saw on my desk.
Okay.
I guess the question is, are the representational issues specific to the fact because it is an actual place? If he removed it from the literalism of being a neighborhood in New York, does that change the conversation?
I don't know. What strikes me is that the film is marketed as this celebration of community. And yet when, you know, there are critiques made about it, they, you know, revert to sort of this conversation about like, oh, it's like, it's a Fantasia, it's a musical, you know, it's not exactly Washington Heights. But if that were the case, then why is the narrative of community and like celebration and togetherness being used?
Sandra, when you were up in the Heights having conversations with folks in the neighborhood, was representation on their minds? Was it part of the conversation that you were having with them?
I think everyone was just excited to see celebrities. I think they were also very excited to have a movie about the neighborhood that had nothing to do with drug dealing and shootouts and crime. And so I didn't get from my interviews of, you know, people that were outside waiting at the United Palace, I didn't get that anyone had seen the movie yet, but everyone was pretty excited about the fact that it existed.
Assuming the worst, assuming the shortcomings that are the source of the critical pushback, assuming the worst, does the existence of In the Heights have a potential upside in the sense that it does maybe make space for more stories? Maybe it's a step, if not the final step. Does it do any of that work?
In my opinion, there's no question, right? I think that what In the Heights does is it kind of helps with the Hollywood infrastructure to sort of present another fully Latino story. And so I am appreciative of its ability to lay down road, you know, for more Latino stories coming out of Hollywood that are fully Latino in the sense that there's a Latino writer, Latino cast, a producers, just behind the scenes and in front of the scenes. And the fact that it's so successful does tell Hollywood that there is an appetite for this sort of thing. So there is that positive thing about In the Heights where it's paving road, right?
It's hard. It's hard to like just limit the conversation to like questions of representation, right? Because for me, like, I don't know, I worry about like when projects like this are sort of like used to push conversations about like Latinidad or like a monolithic vision of what Latinidad is. To me, what I want to see are not sort of these like community-wide celebration type projects, but actually like more specificity and like more voices and more like stories that kind of show that we are not a homogenous community. And so for me, I struggle with it because it's sort of like, how are things like this or like culture moments like this always used as like these like flashpoints sort of for these conversations? And yet, you know, it seems that like we're having the same conversations year after year about it. I think there is like a huge conversation happening in Hollywood right now about like the need for Latino stories, whatever that means. But I do wonder if maybe the fact that this has created such a big conversation or such a big blowback, perhaps there is hope that in the future that won't happen again.
I just wanted to say that as a Black Dominican woman who grew up in New York, who spent a lot of time in Washington Heights, oftentimes my complexion feels like a stain, you know, that Latinos do not want to acknowledge. It is not acknowledged in music. It is not acknowledged in movies. It is not acknowledged in plays. when I watched In the Heights, it was sort of a lot of the same, you know? I didn't even have a feeling about it because it was just like, okay, business as usual. But what I am grateful for is for the people who spoke out and are not desensitized by the erasure of Black Latinos in art. You know, they did drop the ball. Dominicans are Black. 90% of Dominicans are Black. And to make a movie about them and only show lighter-skinned Dominicans is remiss of telling the story of the population, which is what I think In the Heights tried to do. On top of that, it is important to keep present the fact that In the Heights is not a story about a real Dominican guy who owns a bodega who wants to go back to DR, or a real young girl who wants to make it in the fashion industry, right? In the Heights is Lin-Manuel's interpretation of his peripheral view of the neighborhood. Manhattan is a type of town where one block is the hood and the next block, everyone owns their home and there's a BMW parked on that block in front of every house. And Lin-Manuel happened to grow up in one of those blocks where it was not the hood, you know, it was, you know, his father worked for several mayorship administrations in the city. And so Lin-Manuel did not experience the same heights that I would experience or my friends experience, you know. The heights that he knew is the one he went through. The movie, I felt like, was a fire escape view of what the heights really is, as opposed to someone who's on the ground, who's at these parties, you know. And that's an important element to not miss when it comes to this movie. On top of that, Dominicans have very recently started to gain cognizance of their Blackness. And I think that the culture, or those who claim to, you know, be proponents of Dominican and Latinx culture, should support that instead of not including any Dominicans of a darker complexion in the movie. And when you do include a Black person, it's an African-American who has one of the lead roles in the movie. It's very difficult. And that's one thing that you can't explain on social media, right? There's no room for nuance. There's no room for different layers on social media. But I understand the mob, you know. Here's Lin, you know, making a play in a movie about Black people, Black culture. There's a line in the movie where Abuela goes, you know, we survived slave ships to a completely light-skinned room. And I remember hearing that and going, as a very visibly Black Dominican, I remember hearing that and going, who survived? And that's not to take away from Afro-Latinos who are light-skinned. It's just to say that a Black Dominican like myself, whose Blackness is very visible upon first laying eyes on her, on me, there's no hiding it. There's no ambiguity with me or my mother or my dad or my brother. We are 100% Black the second you see us. For a movie to be about our community and our culture, our meals like plátanos con mangú con salchichón, and our music like merengue, things that we created, and to not include us is very hurtful and it's unfair. It's the same gaslighting that Black Latinos have always experienced from the Latinx community. I just hope that In the Heights opens up roadways for that Black Dominican girl who's in her apartment right now. Like, you know what? I'm going to write a real In the Heights story. And that the infrastructure supports her, because this movie just did not do it.
We good. Isabella, Sandra, what, you know, what else is there to say? We good. Thank y'all so much for coming through and chatting about this very fraught and frictive subject matter. I really appreciate it. I know it's tricky, but I appreciate y'all coming through.
Thank you so much for having me, John.
Thank you.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
My name is Thomas Gibbsneff. I'm a journalist at the New York Times. I served in the Marine Corps as an infantryman. When it comes to reporting on the front line, a lot of the same basics are at play. You're looking at the map of where you're going. If you're on a paved road, field roads, you know, is there a hospital nearby? Is your body armor affixed with the first aid kit? Does everyone know where that first aid kit is? We arrive into a military position. I get out of the car. I look at my watch. You know, I set a timer, no more than an hour. I'm listening for drones, jets, check in with the team. Is everyone comfortable? And if they are, then we proceed. Frontline reporting is dangerous, but I think nothing is more important than talking to the people involved, you know, hearing their stories and being able to connect that with people thousands of miles away. Anything that can make something like this more personal, I think, is well worth the risk. New York Times subscribers make it possible for us to keep doing this vital coverage. If you'd like to subscribe, you can do that at nytimes.com/subscribe.
For part two of this week's episode, you may wonder sometimes, how did people get on podcasts? Okay, nobody wonders that. Maybe sometimes. Anyway, there are a lot of paths, but Lena Wilson, who's here with us today, Lena has a unique one of one path. First off, hello, Lena.
Hello there.
Frequent listeners of podcasts know that I spend an inordinate amount of time, energy, emotional resources on TikTok. They understand that. And a few months ago, I come across Lena's page. Her handle is Neil's Mom. Go follow. Smash that like. Doing film criticism. And I'm thinking, huh, criticism on TikTok. How about that? Phenomenal. Very excited. Follow. Keep watching the videos, and I'm like, okay, this is cool. This is just like, I'm learning a lot. I'm also just like, you know, like I'm a critic, like I'm interested in how this is functioning in this different space. And then I see a video, and Lena's like holding up a copy of the New York Times. I'm like, huh, okay, go off. I didn't even know. Phenomenal. So here's Lena writing in the New York Times. And then I'm like, you know what? I should Google, because like I'm just out here. I need to like unify all my knowledges. And I Google, and it turns out that Lena actually works at the New York Times, right in my own backyard.
Surprise.
Regardless, we'd be happy to have you on, even if you did not have an nytimes.com email address. However, how convenient that you do.
Yes. Well, thank you for sending me one of the like top five most surreal work emails I've ever received, asking me
to
be on here.
That's what we're here for, especially for myself, who is not on Slack. So, you know, we have to use the work email. Lena, I wanted you to come and talk, because I saw a video that you posted on TikTok about the differences, or some of the differences, between In the Heights, the stage musical, and In the Heights, the film. And you, to ground this conversation, you present yourself in this video as something of a musical theater aficionado, detail-oriented, perhaps even a musical theater nerd.
Absolutely. That is absolutely the terminology I use.
I don't want to slander you unless it is with your own language. Can you talk us through your early engagement with In the Heights when it was on stage? Talk us through that.
I think I'll start off by saying I think I earned the right to be slandered when I like corrected a bunch of people from saying play into saying musical as like a 15-year-old, you know? So shove me in a locker for this episode.
First of all, we salute and stan accurate language on podcasts. So you're in the right home.
So I was really big into musical theater, particularly in high school, although it's always been a lifelong love of mine. And I actually had the privilege of seeing the first iteration of the In the Heights first national tour in 2009, because its first stop was in Tampa, Florida, where I went to high school.
So In the Heights, off-Broadway 2007, on-Broadway 2008, national tour 2009.
Yeah, I think it was probably fresh off the Tony win at that point.
At that time, did you take to it? Were you into it? Like, you know, where did it kind of rank for you as someone who was passionate about the form?
Oh my God, I became immediately obsessed. I mean, the last like 5 or so years of musical theater fandom have been completely surreal for me because like Lin-Manuel Miranda was at that first performance of the national tour just to introduce the show. Like he was just this little dude who came up on stage and was like, thanks for coming. And everyone was like, cool, we don't know who you are. And now welcome to the reality of theater culture. So it's been really amazing to see how fast his career has taken off. But I feel like I've been kind of an annoying hipster about Lin-Manuel Miranda for the last 5 or so years, because, you know, everyone was raving about Hamilton. And I was like, well, he has this other musical. It's really good. And I don't know. I mean, a lot of my work and a lot of my criticism like focuses around the ways like marginalized identities are portrayed on film in particular. But I guess that's all to say that I personally find it a little more interesting to just like hear about the everyday lives of Latinos than I do to hear about the founding of our country. So In the Heights has always been a bit more in my wheelhouse, and I've always been kind of an evangelist for it. It's amazing to see, you know, it come to the big screen.
So before we get into the kind of the quibbles, because I know there's quibbles, before we get to the quibbles, big picture, film critic, 20,000 feet up view, is it a successful transition? And is it, as a film, do you find it to be emotionally effective, structurally well executed, so on and so forth?
I find it to be incredibly well executed because a movie musical and a musical are two entirely separate entities, right? Like you have movie musicals, particularly we think of like the 1960s and 70s, where like that was the entity. It was only a movie musical. It was not a stage adaptation, or, you know, an adaptation of something that was once on stage. And I feel like in this film, John M. Chu really returns to a lot of those roots. I know that like Tony Scott in his own criticism of the film for our paper, like compared the 96,000 scene to a Busby Berkeley sort of situation, which, you know, felt really resonant. I think like you have things that you cannot practically do logistically in a theater production that you can do in a film. And I think that some of those things can heighten a musical number. And that was done quite masterfully in quite a few of these numbers. The ones that come top of mind are 96,000 and Paciencia y Fe. At the same time, I do feel like that was privileged over sort of this emotional payoff that does exist in the theatrical version, and that I do think does exist in part because theater is naturally more stripped down than film. When you have solo vocals, you have like a zoom in on that person or a spotlight on that person, and the editing didn't allow for some of that in the film. And it also cut some characters and cut some character beats that I think made the musical a bit stronger.
You mentioned one song in particular that's in the musical, but not in the film. It's early. It kind of helps with Abuela Claudia's character. Can you talk a little bit about that?
We have 23 songs in the musical proper, right? And 17 in the film. So 6 songs, more than a quarter of the original songs have been cut to make room for this film. And actually, the last song chronologically that was cut is the one that I'm referring to. It's called Everything I Know, and it's supposed to be sung by the character Nina after the death of Abuela Claudia, which obviously still happens in the film, but is sort of like entrenched in 3 to 4 different musical moments, as opposed to sort of being separated out into this one, which is the song Alabanza. So Everything I Know comes after Alabanza and is this exploration by Nina of all of the things that this character, Abuela Claudia, meant to the neighborhood throughout decades. It's so beautiful. Makes me cry every time. I literally, like, in preparation for this podcast, was just watching, like, you know, high school theater kids, do an amateur performance of this song on YouTube and sobbing.
I hadn't even begun to contend with the notion that there must be hundreds of thousands of YouTube videos of high school productions of In the Heights.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And they're gorgeous. Shout out to those.
Okay, so let's play a little bit of Everything I Know from the original.
In this folder, there's a picture from my high school graduation with the program mint condition and a star beside my name. Here's a picture of my parents as I left for California.
Nina, played by Mandy Gonzalez in the musical and on the musical soundtrack, played by Leslie Grace in the film. And quick sidebar, we talked a little bit about bachata in the first segment. Leslie Grace actually first got on in a real way singing bachata. She was actually signed originally, I'm pretty sure it's the label that first had Prince Royce signed. And she came out in the same way by singing a bilingual bachata version of a sort of well-known older song. In her case, it was Will You Still Love Me Tomorrow. Let's actually listen to a little bit of OG Leslie Grace. Tonight you're mine.
So you've got this beautiful moment in song that encapsulates everything that this woman has meant to this neighborhood. And as I said in my video, you know, the movie can tell us that all they want, but I think that this song shows us it in this really gorgeous, heart-wrenching way. And it also makes the connection between Abuela Claudia and Nina a lot more intimate than it was necessarily in the movie. And this sort of gets to the crux of my main issue with the translation from stage to screen. And I want to go to a moment after Chita Rivera is mentioned in the film, when Usnavi, Anthony Ramos's character, has like this crowd of children that he's narrating the story to walk through a list of like famous Latino women throughout history. And I was rewatching the film and looking at that and I was like, that's so cool. Why did you being the makers of the film, like downgrade all the female characters in your original stage play to create this film? Nina had a mother who has a solo number that is quite beloved by fans of the show. So obviously that's cut because her mother is now dead. Abuela Claudia has a lot more musical moments, including one where she and Usnavi are planning to go to Puerto Plata together. That's also not established as early on in the narrative as it is in the film, which is interesting because there's like, sorry, I could get really...
No, but that's, but that point is interesting because there is, for me in the film, I only, and I said this in the first segment, but I'll say it again here. I only saw the stage production on a VHS, like on a television at the library. But there is, at the end, when Usnavi finds the lottery ticket that is left for him, to me, there was a gap in that narrative. I'm not saying that it was a total shock, but what you're describing is a more robust establishment of the hand-in-hand relationship of Claudia and Usnavi. And I feel like that has been kind of like thinned out to the point where at the end, even though I know it's coming because I've seen it before, I'm still just like, huh, okay. all right. You know, so I feel you on that.
The number I'm referring to is called Hundreds of Stories. And not only does it establish like the ways in which those characters' dreams intertwine, it also gets to the root of Usnavi's attachment to the Dominican Republic, which I feel like they substituted in the film by saying that he lived there until he was 8. Whereas in the musical, he came on a ship from the DR to New York when he was a baby, or when he was still in utero, actually, because that's when they named him, was on their trip from DR to New York.
Right. And they sort of put that part of the narrative on Sonny.
Yeah. Or like his father had traveled between DR and New York and seen a U.S. Navy ship and decided to call him Usnavi during one of those trips. So like he has this established past, whereas in the musical, I think like to him, the DR represents a more abstract sort of paradise. And I think that that's really interesting, this idea of like, I feel like we grew up with all these immigrant stories of like dreaming and longing for America from your, you know, place of origin and not the other way around. And I don't think that like what the movie does necessarily undercuts that, but it does make it a little flimsier.
There's always going to be sacrifices when you're moving from one discipline or medium to another. Or I should say rethinkings. Sacrifices might be too strong. Depends on the circumstance.
Well, they did literally murder a woman, so.
Do you feel like, in essence, what they were trying to preserve was not the narrative cohesion that was present in the original storytelling, but the kind of grandeur and the spectacle, and therefore they were willing to let go of some of those songs that functioned for storytelling, but maybe not as much for performance?
I think it comes down to two things. The first being that film narratives are less comfortable with ensemble casts, just as a rule. So I think Usnavi is assigned to this position of main character that he doesn't necessarily have in the musical. He's a narrator.
Totally fair.
Right? Like he tells the story and the story happens around him, but that's not because he is central to it necessarily. And so in order to make him the main character for this movie, like, you know, you have a lot more content between him and Vanessa, which I think is not handled particularly fantastically. The fight that they have during the blackout number is supposed to happen between Nina and Benny, actually, and there's no random slut shaming thrown in there ever.
And also as a sidebar to the Nina and Benny thing, something that I know has been brought up a lot in the criticism of the film is that in the musical, Nina's father has a part of that storyline is that Benny is black and Nina's father is uncomfortable with that. But that seems to be completely excised from the film.
And those characters actually end the musical still on icy terms. Like, they're never friends. This all sort of leads into Nina's character. Her light is dimmed a little bit. Benny's character, his light is dimmed a little bit. Usnavi's much more important just overall, because you have this future of him with a child and with Vanessa forever. And you don't actually really know what happens to any of these other characters by the end of the film. And then I think the other huge difference in this film is that they're bringing in a lot of, you know, sort of intense real world issues to try and ground the story in something more rooted in politics and more rooted in identity. And you see that particularly through the figure of Nina, because she originally drops out of Stanford because she flunks out, essentially. She's working two jobs and unable to maintain her finances and her grades at the same time. And so she feels like she's this like jewel of the neighborhood. They refer to her as a star in Spanish a lot during the song Breathe. And she just like sort of crumbles under the pressure. And then in the film version, you have her sort of crumbling under the external pressures of racism from within an elite school rather than from within herself, almost.
The microaggressions of being very much on the outside at Stanford and all the kind of like small indignities that come with that. And then threading that through with the Dreamers conversation and the protest, which then kind of like gives her a spark or a purpose and helps her make the decision to return.
Right. So bringing it back around, in Everything I Know, she's remembering all these times that Abuela Claudia, who can barely write her own name, sat down and did her homework with her. And she sees that Abuela Claudia has kept like a pristine version of her high school graduation program. And after singing that song is when she goes to her parents. She has two of them in the musical. I'm not bitter. It's fine. And says, you know, I don't want to waste this opportunity.
Before we go, I feel like this is maybe more of an abstract critic to critic question, but like sometimes I feel I'll be listening to something or watching something. And I'm kind of like, I know too much walking in the door, and it's hard to arrive at a perspective or a feeling that's not contingent upon my prior perspective and feeling and knowledge. And I wonder, given the intensity of your knowledge and understanding and appreciation of the original, do you think it's even possible critically to see or engage with the film outside of that, to form some kind of, not that anything's objective, but some kind of removed opinion that's not strictly shaped by your understanding of what was shifted and twisted between the musical and the screen?
I mean, it's difficult because I know the ways in which this narrative could be emotionally stronger, but I also don't necessarily think that the narrative changes that they made are one-to-one weaker or worse. Like, I think keeping in this idea of dreams and dreamers is something that's really interesting. I think, you know, one of the lines that in Abuela Claudia's solo, Paciencia y Fe, that was kept for the movie that I think demands more attention before the line that's supposed to be, what do I do with this winning ticket, that was changed for the purposes of sort of reorienting that narrative. She says, "Ay, mama, what do you do when your dreams come true? I spent my life inheriting dreams from you." And so you have this generations long narrative of what it means to be someone who not only is just a person existing in a neighborhood, but someone who represents an entire community. And I think you see that in Carnaval del Barrio. You see that in the opening number. You see that in the finale, of course. But yeah, I don't know that like rooting this in real world issues is the wrong way to tell the story necessarily. But personally, I think that the more emotionally resonant way would have been to to give some of these characters a little bit more of their due. And, you know, culturally speaking, I do think it's worth saying that, like, Latino women are a huge part of households in neighborhoods like Washington Heights, and sort of downplaying the role that they play in dynamics like the ones portrayed in this movie does a bit of the disservice to those dynamics as well. I mean, the solo that Nina's mother would have had is called Enough, and it's literally just her telling her husband and her daughter off for being petty to each other. And you see that on stage, and it always gets like an interrupted, like whooping, clapping, cheering moment, because like those characters need that. And I think in some of these changes, and also in some of the ways that the medium of film editing, like, didn't allow for some of the comedic timing necessary to the musical staging, you do just lose a little bit of that heart.
My feeling about that was, especially when you have a director like John Chu, you want to create the opportunities for these kind of spectacles that fill every corner of the screen. And I think what you said earlier is right, which is when you're seeing things, and unfortunately I didn't see this in a theatrical setting, but in general, when you're seeing things in that setting, you as a viewer, you're sitting in a chair, there's a patience that comes with it, and you're more willing to focus on smaller things, quieter things, you're willing to linger with a character much longer in that setting. It's harder to linger with a character in a film, certainly one as busy as this. And I think dispositionally busy as this. Not all film is busy, obviously, but this film is dispositionally busy. And I think because of that, all these sacrifices that you're identifying in a literal sense, they're also emotional and tonal sacrifices.
And that's another way that it's difficult for me as someone who like blasted this soundtrack in my high school car to separate myself as a viewer is like, you know, during Alabanza, for instance, there's like this, there's a woman in the background belting like Alabanza Doña Claudia. And I'm like, that's supposed to be Vanessa. Why am I not seeing Vanessa's face right now? You know, so I think like you have these musical solos and musical cues that don't belong to the characters that, you know, you remember them to belong to as well.
So basically what you're saying is you need an apology for the rewriting of your childhood memories and affections, right?
Justice for Camila, for sure. That's Nina's mom. Justice for Camila.
Okay. So first of all, so definitely at Neil's mom on TikTok with some of those, that apology energy, if anybody affiliated with the production would like to step up.
They make two really interesting lyrical changes. We can get into the weeds with this or not. One of them is in 96,000, they changed the line, Donald Trump and I on the links and he's my caddy, to Tiger Woods and I on the links and he's my caddy. Probably wise. Then you've got Benny's dispatch, and he says, don't take the Deegan, Big Poppy is in town this weekend. Big Poppy is David Ortiz, who played for the Red Sox until 2016, which means that this film is set at the latest in 2016.
And we probably shouldn't get in the weeds, but I did struggle with trying to identify what year this film took place in.
That original line was Manny Ramirez, both of whom are Red Sox players, because the Deegan goes to Yankee Stadium. So it's supposed to be like a big game is happening this weekend.
Interesting.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So the last thing is, if anybody out there knows what year this is supposed to be, please send us an email at podcast@whattimes.com, because I'm certainly very curious. All right, Lena, I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. This has been a dream come true.
Salchichon!
That is our show. Thank you to Isabella Herrera, Sandra Garcia, Lena Wilson. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast, including the one we did with Lin-Manuel Miranda like 100 years ago. So go find that. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get audio content. That's Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Get on the Facebook group. Get in the Discord, which I know I always say I'm going to do, but I never do. Our producer and ambivalent person about Lin-Manuel Miranda, it's Pedro Rosado from Head Stepper Media. We'll be back next week. Let's go out with something from the original musical soundtrack. This is a duet with Lin-Manuel and Karen Olivo. This is Champagne.
So I got you a present. I went downtown to get it. Doing anything tonight?
Cleaning.
Done for the day?
No way.
Cause we got a date.
Okay.
before you board that plane. I owe you a bottle of cold champagne.
No.
Yeah, cold champagne.
Damn, the bottle's all sweaty and everything. You
went... This podcast is supported by the following advertisement.
At Morgan Stanley, old school hard work meets bold new thinking to help you see untapped possibilities and relentlessly work with you to make them real. To learn more, visit morganstanley.com/whyus. Investing involves risk. Morgan Stanley Smith Barney, LLC.